The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
My name is Trent Leach. I am the academic dean at Care Paravel Latin School. I've also been a teacher there for 12 years, teaching philosophy and theology. How many of you, just before I start, how many of you attended the Dr. Turley's presentation yesterday on Beauty Matters? Okay, I just want a warning. Dr. Turley plagiarized about a third of my presentation. And so as I was sitting there reading through it, listening, I had my notes in front of me thinking, yeah, okay, I've covered that, that's good. But it looks like there's enough of you at least that there won't be, that I just want to put that forward, that he's copying me, and I'm not copying, even though I'm going second, because it looks like I'm going to be the one that's getting in trouble. But it does show that I think we both have similar concerns about a central problem in education and the wider culture, but we're going to approach it in two very different ways. Dr. Turley, I was talking with him before the presentation, accused him of plagiarism, and he's trained in music and theology, and all of my training is in analytic philosophy, and so we're going to approach things very differently with regard to this question of beauty. But some of it I am going to gloss over a little bit, just because I don't want to duplicate too much. But I will start a little differently than I had planned in reading a passage about beauty to sort of situate part of the problem that we have with regard to beauty. And this is from Dostoevsky, from the Brothers Karamazov. This is Ivan railing about beauty. And I think it's quite telling what he says about, and what he says here kind of hits the heart of why beauty is so problematic. And Ivan is, if you're familiar with the story, Ivan is the middle brother. He's the cool, calm, rationalist, atheist of the three brothers and the Karamazov brothers. And this is what he has to say about beauty. And he's talking to his younger brother, Alyosha. He says, "Beauty is a terrible and awful thing. It is terrible because it has not been fathomed and never can be fathomed, for God sets us nothing but riddles. Here the boundaries meet and all contradictions exist side by side. I am not a cultivated man, brother, but I've thought a lot about this. It's terrible what mysteries there are. Too many riddles weigh men down on earth. We must solve them as we can and try to keep a dry skin in water. Beauty. I can't endure the thought that a man of lofty mind and heart begins with the ideal of the Madonna and ends with the ideal of Sodom. What's still more awful is that a man with the ideal of Sodom in his soul does not renounce the ideal of the Madonna, and his heart may be on fire with the ideal, genuinely on fire, just as in his days of youth and innocence. Yes, man is broad, too broad indeed. I'd have him narrower. The devil only knows what to make of it. What to the mind is shameful is beauty and nothing else to the heart. Is there beauty in Sodom? Believe me that for the immense mass of mankind, beauty is found in Sodom. Do you know that secret? The awful thing is that beauty is mysterious as well as terrible. God and the devil are fighting there, and the battlefield is the heart of man. But a man always talks of his own ache. And so now listen to the facts." And so I don't think it's a controversial statement to say that beauty lacks a certain elevation or a certain respect in our broader culture and even within our own communities. And this is what Dr. Turley pointed out. And it's like, well, okay, you know, the denigration of beauty, yeah, we've seen that. You know, Lewis opens The Abolition of Man, his treatise on education, with this comment that really the attack on education begins with an attack on beauty, and that's the back door towards all the destructive things that happen in education. What Dr. Turley said yesterday is the same experience I've had in teaching in these last 12 years. I teach a two-year course called the Great Ideas, in which we spend a semester looking at one of the six great ideas, each one from Plato to sort of Nietzsche and Sartre. And so we go through truth and goodness and justice, freedom, equality, and then beauty. And the students are all on board with regard to truth and what truth is and with regard to justice, freedom, inequality, and goodness. But without fail, when you get to beauty, there's either a hesitation that beauty is anything real, or there's this outright rejection that beauty is anything real. And it seems to happen over and over and over again. Now, they tend to come around by the end of the semester, most of them do, but at the beginning, right, it's always this, now beauty is different than these other ideas. And, you know, many students and people have, you know, philosophers behind them. The great modern philosopher Descartes says, neither the beautiful nor the pleasant signifies anything other than the attitude of our judgment to the object in question. Right? Baruch Spinoza, beauty is less a quality of the object studied than the effect arising in the man studying the object. Charles Darwin, of course, the sense of beauty obviously depends on the nature of the mind, irrespective of any real quality in the admired object. What do you want to guess Sigmund Freud thought beauty came from? Anybody? Mom? Close? Psychoanalysis, he says, unfortunately, has scarcely anything to say about beauty. All that seems certain is that beauty's derivation is from the field of sexual feeling, right? And that's all there is to it, right? Now, one of the things that's always frustrated me about beauty, coming to these conferences and talking with people, is that we tend to think that, okay, so we have the classical view of beauty, which is a little misleading to talk about a classical view of beauty, because there are all sorts of, you find skeptics about beauty all the way back to in the Greeks as well, right? It's all there. And then you have sort of in tracing it up to the medieval world and the moral imagination, all of that. And then there's what the modern view of beauty says. And so then it's always sort of pitted as, so here's the modern degradation of beauty, and then here's what we believe. And then that's it. It's like you just have to choose one, but I found it frustrating that aren't there any persuasive reasons? Aren't there any good arguments we can give? Am I just stuck with saying, well, no, we just need to teach our kids this one and teach them that one's wrong and this one's right? Is there anything more we can do to help them see that there are good reasons for why we hold to the objectivity of beauty and the beauty is, has these certain qualities? Yeah, I find this comes up a lot. I remember my very first conference, classical Christian conference. It was a similar issue with regard to language, and the presenter talked about Derrida and the deconstructionist and how they've destroyed language. And then it was, but here's what we believe. Why choose one or the other? Can we talk them? Is there a reason for rejecting the deconstructionist and Derrida and things for what, a logos-centric view of language? And so that's kind of where I've come with regard to this question of beauty, is can we do any better than just saying, well, here's what some people believe, but here's what we believe, right? Can we offer any apologetic for beauty, might be the way I would put it. And the apologetic approach that I've taken, that I want to test out today, we'll see how it goes, I don't know. I'm a philosopher, I like to argue. One of the things I don't like sometimes about the ACCS conference is there's too much agreement. Too many people nodding their heads, and none of people arguing about ideas. So I'm hoping we can find somebody to argue with me, make me defend some of these ideas a little more deeply. And part of the trouble we have with defending beauty is that, as Ivan pointed out, it is so deeply mysterious. Right? And we hear these great lectures on beauty, and I'm blown away by these lectures on beauty, but then I'm left thinking, but what do I do with that? How do I show a person who doesn't believe that there's anything to beauty, the truth of what I just heard? I think Mortimer Adler really puts it together pretty well, the frustrations that I have often felt with beauty when he writes in his book, Six Great Ideas. He says, much has been said about the subject of beauty that will not bear close scrutiny. What is said is often moving, even uplifting. It frequently gives one the sense of being on the verge of getting at the heart of the matter. But at best, it leaves one unsure that the promise of penetrating insights can be fulfilled by patient thought expressed in plain speech. The test of intelligibility of any statement that overwhelms us with its air of profundity is its translatability into language that lacks the elevation and verve of the original statement, but can pass muster as a simple and clear statement in ordinary everyday language. Most of what has been written about beauty will not survive that test. And I felt when I read that, it was like, yeah, that's the problem. I can't take these grand, eloquent ideas and express them in ordinary speech so that I can talk with my neighbor who hasn't listened to these, you know, who doesn't have, you know, 5 hours to sit down and listen to a lecture from me on the nature of beauty. Can we find no commonality, right? And so that's what I want to propose to try to do today, make some simple, clear statements about the nature of beauty that I think we can show that there's good reasons for thinking beauty should be and is objective and has objective content to which we can learn and know and grow and understand. Now, the way I want to go about it is by means of a philosopher, Thomas Reed. How many of you have ever heard of Thomas Reed? Yeah, that's about what I thought. I often say Thomas Reed's maybe the most important philosopher you've never heard of. He rarely appears in anthologies, in like our omnibus books and in the readings of Western civilization, which is unfortunate. He doesn't care parabel, for good reason. So let me just give you a quick sketch of who he was, because this isn't really about him, but just so you have some context of where he's coming from. Reed was a Scottish philosopher. He lived from 1710 to 1796. And he represents an approach to philosophy that's very different from the rest of tradition historically with regard to sort of analytic and what's sometimes called continental philosophy. It's been come to be known as just common sense realism or a common sense philosophy. Reed was trained for the ministry at the University of Aberdeen. He spent about 20 years as an active minister and preacher with the Church of Scotland before he took up a position, a lectureship at the University of Aberdeen. He taught Greek. He had a revival. He brought a revival to the University of classic languages and classic texts. He was married to his first cousin, Elizabeth Reed. They had 9 children. And you'll find in his writings, he often has very insightful, witty things to say about children. One of the things that you, if you do pick up a book on Reed, you'll find is that he is witty, he is sarcastic, and he is funny. It's a rare quality in a philosopher. I just find myself laughing out loud as I read through him because he doesn't pull any punches, and sometimes he's just hysterical. He worked there at the University of Aberdeen for some time until he took up the chair of moral philosophy at Glasgow University. He took up Adam Smith's chair, so a very prestigious position. He wrote 3 books you should be aware of if you're looking to go a little bit deeper into Reed. I recommend you do. One is An Inquiry into the Human Mind on the Principles of Common... You can Google this and find all this. You know, you don't have to get all of it down. They're long titles, as they were at the time. An Inquiry into the Human Mind on the Principles of Common Sense, Essays on the Intellectual Powers of Man, and Essays on the Active Powers of Man. These 3 works are considered a great, I would say, a primer to sort of this common sense school of philosophy. Reed is known for his theories of perception and epistemology. He also developed what's called the geometry of visibles, where he laid the foundations and is often credited with inventing non-Euclidean geometry. So a very powerful and insightful philosopher. But he's also a philosopher who rejected a lot of modern philosophy and said, you guys are nuts. The common man knows far more than most learned philosophers. And I'm going to side with the common man. And he said, I'll defend the vulgar. Is what he'll say, right? Is because there are, when it comes to this idea of what is common sense, right? Well, common sense is probably exactly what you think it is. It's those things that we all know, that sometimes we can't always articulate, that are common to mankind, and that it takes a PhD to doubt, right? Reed says it's genius, not want of genius, that adulterates philosophy, right? There's just some things you have to be brilliant, some things to believe they're so absurd. And so but most of Reed's views on common sense deal with epistemology and responding to people like René Descartes and David Hume. He has very very bad things to say about Descartes and Hume. If you're familiar with Hume, he attacks the notion that we can know cause and effect principles at all, that any kind of cause and effect can be known. And Reed just looks at that and says, it's shocking to common sense to think that, you know, if I drop my iPod here, I can't know, if I let go of it, I can't know if it's going to fall to the ground. And that's what Hume argued, right? And so, you know, Reed has got a great passage where he says, you know, Hume's philosophy is like a man who has a hobby horse in the closet who likes riding it, right? He'd ride it in the closet, but he'd never take it to the public square and ride it. He'd never take it to church and ride it. It's something he does in private because it's kind of shameful to do for a grown man. He says, that's Hume's philosophy. It's shameful for a grown man to think these things, right? So what are the kinds of principles of common sense that he's talking about? Well, how about this? How many of you are relatively rational beings? A few hands went up. Do you trust your reason? Can you prove your reason is reliable? How could you do that? How could you do that in a non-question-begging way? Because you'll have to use your reason and your faculties to prove that your reason and your faculties are reliable, right? And so Reed says, I don't have to prove it, right? It's not my job, right? Because there's you can't doubt them. I have to move in the course of thought and life as if they're reliable. There's no other choice. So any philosopher who wants to begin with this notion of, well, maybe we can't trust our minds, Reed says, nonsense, right? He says, in fact, and that's kind of Descartes who wants to start with doubting, like the existence of the physical world for Descartes, right? Reed says, you can't really do that, right? You can't really doubt these things in any reasonable way. He says, arguing with Descartes is like arguing with a man who thinks he's made out of glass, right? What he needs is not a logician, he needs a physician, right? He needs a doctor. Because you're not going to argue, because he's lost his common sense. He's left the realm of what we all know to be true. And common sense are those principles upon which we all know and think things, right? So Reed says, let these scholastic sophisters, that is a great term, by the way, a scholastic sophister. Let these scholastic sophisters entangle themselves in their own cobwebs. I am resolved to take my own existence, the existence of other things upon trust, and to believe that snow is cold and honey is sweet, whatever they may say to the contrary. He must either be a fool or want to make me a fool that would reason me out of my senses. I confess I know not what a skeptic can answer to this, nor by what good argument he can plead for a hearing, for either his reason is sophistry and so deserves contempt, or there is no truth in the human faculties, and then why would we reason at all? Right? And so that's what, and so Reed then goes along and applies these principles, this idea of common sense, mainly to epistemology. This idea that the things that we can know, we don't have to prove them, we're under no obligation to prove these things, because they're the conditions upon which we reason. Right? They're the axioms of our lives. Right? And they're common to all mankind. Now Reed says, now of course people are going to disagree about some of these principles. And he says, but our divine author, right, has not left us without avenue, or several avenues, if we do disagree. How might we identify principles of common sense? And he's very careful about this. We don't prove principles of common sense so much as we identify them. Because if we prove them, then they're not foundational axioms. Right? When Euclid opens the Elements, he doesn't start with proving a series of axioms. He just states them. These are things we know to be true. I don't have to prove them. Right? That the whole is greater than the part. Right? If two equal sums be added to two equal sums, right, the wholes are equal. I don't have to prove these things, okay? And there are things like that with regard to our mental processes, but if we disagree about them, what do we do? And I'm going to move through these quickly because it's not really the point of the presentation. I want to get to beauty, so apply this notion of that we're things that we all know about beauty, even people who deny beauty is a real thing. There are things they actually know about beauty that can show they actually do believe that beauty is objective, even if they won't admit it. But we need to lay a few of the ground ideas here for how would we know if it's a principle of common sense. Five basic things, six, because one of them is kind of two parts. First, he says there's an argument ad hominem, and this is just an argument for consistency. He says, quote, it's a good argument ad hominem if it can be shown that a first principle which a man rejects stands upon the same footing with others that he admits. For when this is the case, he must be guilty of inconsistency, right? And so we're going to actually see this, and Dr. Turley actually pointed this out. You know, the same reasons that can be given for the subjectivity of beauty, the exact same footing for the subjectivity of really anything, truth, goodness, so that if we accept that truth is objective and goodness is objective, we must, if we're going to be consistent, accept beauty's objectivity as well. He says there's an argument ad absurdum. This works in mathematics a lot. You start with assuming the contrary principle and then showing it leads to a contradiction. This is what Aristotle does in the Metaphysics when we get to the principle of non-contradiction. He says, how do you prove that a thing can't both be and not be at the same time and in the same sense? Well, you can't prove it, but he says, let's doubt it. And he shows 100 absurdities that follow if it's not true. And so therefore, it's true. This one won't come up into play as much with beauty, but it's mainly for mathematical logic reasoning that one will come into play. A big one for Reed will be this argument from what I'm calling universal consent. He said there are some things that appear in beliefs that appear in all places and all times. He says if you find a belief like that, that's a good argument for a common sense principle. Because it's a good indication that it arises naturally out of our experiences. He says we should take seriously the ordinary conduct of life and the consent of ages of the learned and the unlearned alike. Right? You might consider this a fallacy, but for Reed, he says we really should take seriously the things that everyone everywhere has accepted. And if we're arguing for something that every person everywhere has rejected, that should give us some pause that we're maybe off on the wrong track. I've noticed that Anthony Esselin has been making these arguments with regard to the sexual revolution. He says the ideas about the sexual revolution that we have right now are so absurd that no people anywhere at any time has ever held these ideas. He says, and that's a good reason for rejecting them, because they're so contrary to our common sense about basic biology. Right, and if you just follow him on Facebook, you'll see a lot of these great posts that he puts up there. If you're familiar, Anthony Esselin. If you've not heard of Esselin, you need to read his 10 Ways to Destroy the Imagination of a Child. That's a brilliant book. And his most recent, Out of Ashes, is excellent as well. But 10 Ways to Destroy the Imagination of a Child is great. It's a wonderful, sardonic, sarcastic book, an instruction manual for how to kill a child's imagination. It's great. Along with this notion of taking seriously what all people at all times have believed, Reed wants to take seriously the language we use when we talk about things. He says we should pay a serious attention to the way people use words. Right? He says language, and he has a whole theory of language that's fascinating, which would be the topic for a whole other lecture. But he says language is the expression of images and pictures of human thoughts. And from the picture, we may draw some conclusions concerning the original. What is common in the structure of language indicates a uniformity of opinion in those things upon which the structure is grounded. Right? So we need to pay close attention to the way people use words, because it will reveal what they really believe about the world. This is similar to the 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein said that philosophical problems come about when language goes on holiday. When philosophers start using words in the way that nobody uses words, right? He says, and that's the problem, right? He says, the philosophy needs to ground itself. And if those of you looking for dissertation topics, I think a relationship between Reed and Wittgenstein would be a great topic. So we pay attention to the way people use words, and that's going to be one of his arguments with regard to beauty. The way people talk about beauty, they may express they don't believe that beauty is objective, but their language suggests they actually believe it is. Fourthly, he says, is what I would call an argument from nature. He says, opinions that appear so early in the mind of men that they cannot be the effect of education or of false reasoning have good claims to be considered first principles. Things that you don't have to be taught. These would be things like that other people have minds with feelings and emotions, right? The child doesn't have to be taught what mom means when she starts yelling and screaming. And nor does the child doubt that mom's a real person, that she's really mad, right? The child doesn't reflect, well, I wonder if mom's just a robot who's conditioned to respond in particular, right? You don't have to be taught those things. And there's a whole host of these beliefs that we have that are not the result of any education, but arise naturally out of our experience with the world. And Reed says, we need to take those seriously. I don't think this one necessarily comes in too much with regard to beauty, but it's there. Fifthly, he says, is an argument from practice. This one is, he says, there are some things that are so necessary in the conduct of life that without a belief in it, a man must be led into a thousand absurdities. Here, you would use the example of something like free will, right? The notion that people aren't free, if you really believe that, would lead into so many absurdities that it would collapse all human life. Right, I remember there was a great interview that Stephen Colbert did on his old show with Richard Dawkins. And Richard Dawkins, right, the famous atheist, really believes in determinism. He really believes we're not free, we don't have any free will. And Colbert had this great sort of criticism that if he really believes there is no free will, why is he on this book tour taking credit for writing this book? Because it's just the chain of events of cause and effect that led to this, and he deserves no more any more than a computer printer who prints a document. That's all we are, and so there's no reason to take. And Dawkins had no answer for it. It was pretty funny, right? And so any philosopher would say, Reed, that wants to talk you out of the notion that you have to some degree free will over your choices. He says that the person's not. He says, you don't have to take that person seriously. Because it leads to a thousand kinds of absurdities in life. Our whole legal system would collapse because it's predicated on the notion that people can be accountable for their actions, and people are only accountable for their actions if they can, to some degree, choose otherwise. All right. So those are the kinds of things we want to look at. And so, good, I think our time's all right here. So we want to look at this, take the same approach of looking at our experiences of beauty and applying these principles of common sense to say, can we get anywhere beyond the lofty language of beauty to really help ourselves, if we doubt, how can we articulate what beauty is, and help others see that their very experiences of things they call beauty really do suggest that they believe beauty is really something in objects? All right. Maybe I should stop here and see if there's any questions. I think we're in good on time. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, yeah. When we read him in our Great Ideas course with regard to that, it's a similar kind of finding those patterns and the constructions there. Yeah, I forget the name of the book now. It's Polanyi is he was sort of a scientist and an engineer who took up philosophy sort of in the later part of his life and had some great insights, I think, into epistemology that very much in line with a lot of what Reed says, I think. Yeah, so it's a good recommendation. Okay. all right, so what might we say about beauty that we can all agree on as a basic principle of common sense? I've got four, I would say, very modest proposals here, right? Four things that I think we can take away, and from there we can do some broader reasoning with regard to beauty. The first is that beauty is simply that which pleases. Beauty is, in some way, an agreeable experience. I mean, anyone who encounters something and says, that's awful, and I hated it, all right, and it was very painful, and it was awful, and it was beautiful, doesn't understand what they're talking about, right? Anyone and anywhere, if we're talking about, even someone who thinks beauty is purely subjective, we label things beautiful, which please us, and it's agreeable in some way. We like it in some way. Now, there is a kind of longing and what Plotinus would call a keener wound of love, that there is this kind of painful drawing, but it's a pleasurable kind of painful. But to some degree, Reed says, when beautiful things are perceived or even imagined, they produce an agreeable emotion. We agree on that? Because, I mean, even again, the subjectivists will say, yeah, beauty is something pleasant, right? Something that is agreeable in some way when experienced. Even if we don't think there's something in the object, we at least agree that it's a pleasure of some kind, right? It's not something that we avoid usually, right? We seek out music that we like, right? Because it brings us pleasure. And we, even if we think that there's nothing beautiful in the music itself and we think it's all in us, we still like it because it brings us pleasure. Sound good? Okay. So much for that one. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, and I would say that would be what Plotinus would call the keener wound of beauty. But it's a beauty that is still in some way desirable, even to the degree that it's painful. There's a beauty in the pain of the cross. It's something that even, you know, Lewis talks about this, I think, in Mere Christianity, about the longing that we experience when beauty and joy is absent. Even the longing and the pain is in some way desirable and pleasant. We'd rather long for beauty and not have it than not long for it at all. right? So I think even in those things, there is a desirability with regard to it. I think most people would agree. Everything that is beautiful pleases. I'm sorry. While that which is beautiful pleases, not everything that is pleasant is beautiful. Right? We experience different kinds of pleasures. Right? And beauty is a particular kind of pleasure. Again, this is purely subjective beauty. If we think about what are the kinds of objects we tend to think about as beautiful? Roses, paintings, sunsets, persons. Right? What do all those have in common? We perceive them with our eyes. They're visible, right? Well, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that enjoying the pleasure or the beauty, right, or I should say receiving the pleasure of those kinds of objects, I don't have to be in any kind of physical contact with them. I don't have to possess them. I simply have to behold them. The same is also true of music. Right? I don't have to own the copyright to a piece of music in order to derive pleasure from it. Right? I don't have to consume. Now, we might say a strawberry is beautiful, right? But it's usually in its presentation in some way, or the way it looks, its shape, its form. But when we taste it, we don't normally talk about things tasting beautiful. Now, there is an exception, and that would be like a sommelier with wine. We'll talk about the beauty of the flavor. Right, but there, think about what's happening with the person who tastes the wine and can talk about its beauty. It's not in the physicalness that they identify the beauty, but the degree to which it triggers something in the imagination. Right, it goes to the mental, and I'm not going to be particular about saying the mind here. It's the soul. It's the affection. It's something beyond the physical is all we really mean to hold here. This is why St. Thomas Aquinas says that beauty relates to the cognitive faculty. For beautiful things are those which please when seen. And by seen, he just means the metaphorical sense of seen, not the physical sense. Right? Like when I said, do you see what I mean? Do you understand with your mind? Right? And that's where we derive the pleasure of the beautiful objects. Right? It's the pleasure of beauty is in the beholding. That's all I need. Right? And that's all there has to be for something to be enjoyed. And so notice that with both of these things, that the beauty is something that's pleasant and that the pleasure exists in the mind are purely subjective, right? And so even those who hold to what we might call aesthetic subjectivism hold to this idea, right? Because it's just what beauty is. It's a pleasant experience that's not really physical in any kind of tangible way. It's also why we can say that you can increase your experiences of an enjoyment of beauty as you increase your understanding of the object of beauty, right? If I have no understanding of what I'm beholding, I can't really derive much pleasure from it, right? And so it takes a mind to enjoy pleasure. And I've been involved in a lot of theater in my life, and I practice and I rehearse at home, and I'm walking around my house rehearsing my lines and working on these Shakespearean soliloquies with my two dogs just looking up at me. They're not moved by it at all. Now, admittedly, I'm a bad actor, right? I don't think that's it, right? But they lack the capacity to enjoy the beauty of a Shakespearean soliloquy, right? Now, they can be moved with regard to certain music and things. They can enjoy that, but not in the same way, right? As I increase my understanding of things, I increase my capacity to enjoy them, which shows that the object of beauty that the idea of beauty is in some way located in the mind or the understanding. It's something we contemplate, right? It's the intellective capacity, as Thomas says. And so again, I don't think we've said anything at this point that's really all that controversial. Even those who don't believe that there is anything objective in an object, or objective with regard to beauty in an object, would deny either of these principles. It's really just what we mean by beauty. Beauty is something that's pleasant, and the pleasure is some way experienced through the mind, even if it touches the soul and those kinds of, you know, the moral affections, those kinds of things. Okay, it's nothing really controversial, I don't think. The controversial one is the next one, because now we're going to locate beauty in an object. Okay, and I'm going to argue on the basis of common sense that anybody who holds to this subjective experience of common sense really does believe that there's something in an object that's beautiful. So the third common sense principle that I put forward is that beauty is an expression of some excellence in an object. Very vague and very broad. It's intended to be. That's what the fourth one's for, so I'll get to that in a second. On this one, Reed asks us to point out, or just points out this notion that whenever we experience something we call beautiful, there are two parts to the experience. Right? First is my pleasure, my enjoyment. And second is my attitude towards the thing that caused my pleasure. There's always those two things. There's the, hey, that's made me feel really good, and hey, that's really great. That thing which caused my pleasure is good. It's excellent in some way. It's fine in some way. That is, in the experience of the pleasure of the mental faculty, there arises in the mind a judgment about the thing. We have an attitude about the thing that causes our pleasure. We like it. Something good there, right? And so go back to our first principles there and the things that can indicate a first principle, and think about the way people talk about beautiful objects. Even those who say they deny that beauty is objective. Here's what Reed says. He says, "My language, according to the necessary rules of construction, can bear no other meaning but this, that there is something in the poem and not in me, which I call beauty. No reason can be given why all mankind should express themselves thus, but that they mean what they say. It is therefore contrary to the universal sense of mankind, expressed in their ordinary language, that beauty is not really in the object, but is merely a feeling that a person has when it's perceived. Philosophers should be very cautious in opposing this common sense of mankind, for when they do, they rarely miss going wrong." Right? We always say that when we experience something that is a pleasurable, sort of beautiful experience. Ah, that's great. That's fine. That's excellent. That always accompanies the experience of beauty. Right? It's always there. And so Reed wants to know, why should I use a language that expresses the contrary of what I mean? If when I encounter Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn and say, wow, I enjoyed that very much, is that really all that I say? It's not all we say. We say, have you seen this poem? Listen to this poem. Same thing with music, right? We hear a song we like, that's a great song, right? Even, again, these are people who would deny that beauty is objective, will say, oh, you got to go see this movie. It's great. But if there's nothing great, if there's nothing that is really in an object, then there's nothing to be great about. There's nothing to point to. In fact, we need to just stop using the word beauty altogether, because there's no such thing as beauty then, right? That's one deal, okay? But there's a deeper problem for Reed with regard to denying beauty as objective, and it's this. That if we deny the objectivity of that beauty expresses some excellence in an object, then we're going to attribute to the mind fallacious faculties. That is, our mind is therefore untrustworthy. Okay, let me explain. It says, when I hear a piece of music that pleases me, I say it is fine, it is excellent. This excellence is not in me, it is in the music. But the pleasure it gives me is not in the music, it's in me. And so whenever, and as I mentioned this before, whenever we encounter an experience of beauty, there always arises an opinion in the mind about the object that causes that pleasant experience. But if there's nothing in the object about which to judge, then our minds automatically are making nonsensical judgments and therefore are untrustworthy. It'd be like every time we encountered a mathematical principle, right, SIC, 2 plus 2 equals 4. Oh, that's so blue. Well, there's no blue. I mean, I know there's syntheses that see colors and numbers and things. But setting that aside, mathematical propositions don't have the quality of color. And so if every time, you know, we experienced a, you know, mathematical principle, we made a judgment with regard to color, we'd say, well, there's something wrong with the mind because there's nothing color, there's no colorness about it. But that's exactly what we're saying with regard to beauty. Because every time we have this experience of beauty, there is both the feeling of pleasure and the judgment, hey, there's something good there. But if there's really nothing good in it, then my mind is making ridiculous judgments, and therefore I shouldn't trust my mind. And if I shouldn't trust my mind, why am I reasoning at all? Let me just read through as I wrote this out. Whenever we encounter something beautiful, it's accompanied by the judgment that there is something excellent in the cause of our pleasure. Every judgment entails a truth or falsity. If there is no truth or falsity about matters of beauty, then we can form no judgment about the enjoyable beauty we experience. If we can form no judgment about the object of beauty, then our experiences of beauty are utterly nonsensical and therefore not to be taken seriously. This is why I think those people who deny that beauty is objective are denying their very experiences and are, to paraphrase Roger Scruton, these people are asking not to be taken seriously, so you shouldn't. But also, to take a more gentler side, it's to point out to them, to show them, right? Someone who denies that beauty is objective, say, just think about your experiences of beauty. Don't you have, when you have something, this experience of beauty, don't you form a judgment about that thing and say that it's good and it's not just that you find it enjoyable, but that there's something in it that is good that is the cause of your enjoyment, right? This would be tantamount to saying that, you know, I eat chocolate and the chocolate is sweet, but there's nothing in the chocolate that causes the sensation of sweetness on the tongue. That doesn't make any sense. There's got to be something in the chocolate that is the cause of the sweetness on the tongue. So too, the cause of pleasure we experience in the object, there has to be something in the object. Now, we're nowhere near what that something is at this point. I'm not arguing that, because that's where we get a little more lofty, and I just want to keep us in everyday plain language. But I just want to point out that people's very experiences of beauty suggest that they really actually believe it's objective. We really do, right? Okay, guys, I want to leave some time for questions, so I'm going to move on here. All right, but what is it that is this excellence in the object? I said this is going to be very broad and very vague, and I wanted it to be there. So this fourth principle, which the more I think about it, may not be a foundational principle, it may be a derived principle, but I'm going to go with it anyway for now. I'm not going to be particular on that one, but I think it works. Beautiful objects vary in both degree and kind. Now let me explain what I mean by this. Reed points out that one thing can be more excellent than another thing. And so therefore they can be degrees of beauty. Right? And I think anyone who recognizes or who has even a subjective experience of beauty recognizes this. Some songs are just better than others. They believe that at least. Nobody really believes that all music is equal. Right? Again, that might be something they say in the privacy of their own home, but they'd never say that in public. Nobody really believes that, right? And we open up our iPods and we find this is the music we really think is good, right? We don't have every kind of music in there, right? Especially sort of even cross-culturally, right? As I listen to like Hindu music, I can't get it, right? I'm just hit a note, right? But I recognize there's probably something there. Right, it's just I lack the capacity to understand it. I realize the problem's in me; it's not in it. Nobody really believes that everything's equal, right? We have preferences, and we think there are degrees with regard to beauty. However, some have taken to rejecting the objectivity of beauty because of this differences of opinion with regard to what we call beautiful. That it seems to vary so greatly. Right? It's that question of who's to say what's beautiful. The opinions are so wide and so varied, right? You talk about films, like we go on Rotten Tomatoes and read all the different film critics. Nobody can seem to agree on anything, so this must mean that there's nothing really excellent and nothing really beautiful in film, because nobody can agree, right? And Reed says that there seems to be no, quote, there seems to be no identity, nor even similarity, between the beauty of a theorem and the beauty of a piece of music. Though both may be beautiful, the kinds of beauty seem to be various as the objects to which they're ascribed. For Reed, beauty is a relational property. It's the expression of an excellent property of an object. And what does excellence mean? I mean, excellence is just, when is a thing excellent? When does anybody say a thing is excellent? When it is as its nature intends it to be, right? My pen writes excellently when it writes as it was designed to write, and therefore can write beautifully, right? Because of the excellence of its nature. And so therefore, beauty depends upon the nature of the object. One of the great frustrations that I experience when dealing with aesthetics and beauty, and Reed points this out, is that we try to narrow down beauty to some singular principle and then apply that principle to all the different kinds of beauty we encounter. Right? So Aristotle says, let me find it here, to be beautiful, a living creature and every whole made up of parts must not only present a certain order in its arrangement of parts, but also must be a certain definite magnitude. Therefore, beauty is a matter of size and order. Okay, that works for maybe living creatures, but how does that work for a theorem? Right? How does that work for the beauty of a person, not just their physical nature, but their personality or their, you know, their soul? Right? How does it work for, how is a sunset, right, a matter of order and size? Right? Plotinus says, almost everyone declares that the symmetry of parts towards each other and towards a whole is beauty. And even Thomas Aquinas says, beauty consists in the wholeness, harmony, and radiance of the object. And so we take these singular principles and then try to apply it to all these different objects. And you just think, it's hard to see how all that a singular principle will apply to all these different things. Is the beauty of a dog really the same as the beauty of a sunset, as far as what makes it beautiful? It's hard to see how. And Reed says, from their love of simplicity, philosophers have reduced beauty to fewer principles than the nature of the thing will permit, having had in their eyes some principal kinds of beauty, and then they overlook other kinds. He says it's the same problem that Descartes went into. He wanted to reduce epistemology to a single principle and then build his epistemology on it, because you can't do it. There are multiple principles, and they're built up from there. There's not a singular principle upon which we build everything. And Reed says it's the same thing with beauty. We shouldn't try to reduce beauty to a single principle and then try to jam that, you know, round peg into a square hole. He says, there are indeed so many species of beauty that it would be difficult to enumerate them perfectly as to enumerate all the tastes we perceive by the palate. Right? He says, the beauty of a demonstration, the beauty of a poem, the beauty of a palace, the beauty of a piece of music, the beauty of a fine woman, and many more that might be named are different kinds of beauty. And we have no names to distinguish them, but the names of the objects themselves to which they belong. It's a beautiful person. It's a beautiful palace. It's a beautiful theorem. That one's harder for me to see. Mathematicians talk about that all the time, the beauty of the theorem. It's just because I lack the understanding, right? I don't see the same thing. We read in our aesthetics section in Great Ideas, we read Heisenberg, is Meaning of Beauty in the Exact Sciences, which is a fantastic article. It was a presentation to a group of artists by a world-renowned physicist. And Heisenberg is fantastic on this, on where beauty fits into the sciences, but some of it really goes over my head, I have to admit. And so we don't need to try to stretch a single definition of beauty into all the different kinds of beauty that are out there. We can be, so what is beauty then in the object? It's the expression of the excellence of the object. And the excellence of the object then will vary depending upon the nature of the object itself. What makes a dog beautiful depends upon what a dog is. Right? What makes a sunset beautiful depends upon what a sunset is. And therefore, my understanding and my ability to enjoy the nature of a piece of music depends upon my understanding and my ability to know the nature of music. Right? So thus are four common sense principles of aesthetics. These principles taken together represent, I think, a very powerful reason for rejecting a subjectivist view of aesthetics and beauty in the modern era, and give us some apologetic towards people who doubt it. We are delighted to experience the beauty of a sunset and the beauty of a poem. The very nature of our experience with beauty, with beautiful objects, testifies that beauty is a real property expressed in the excellence of the objects when we encounter those objects. This property, I'm kind of repeating, but this property is the expression of the internal excellence of the object, and as objects vary in kind, so does the various kinds of beauty. To oppose these principles is to oppose our very encounters with anything we call beautiful, and therefore to oppose the common sense of mankind. So has common sense saved beauty? Well, only if you care about common sense, I would say. Only if you care about being a reasonable person. And if you don't, there's nothing I can do about it for you. Right? And if philosophy comes out to deny these common sense principles, then Reed would say, then get rid of philosophy. It's nonsense. Right? This is what Reed says. It's one of his odes to philosophy. He's speaking to Lady Philosophy herself. He says, "Admired philosophy, daughter of light, parent of wisdom and knowledge, if thou art she, surely thou hast not arisen upon the human mind, nor blessed us with more than thy rays, than are sufficient to shed a darkness visible upon the human faculties, and to disturb that repose and security which happier mortals enjoy, who never approached thine altar, nor felt thine influence. But indeed, if thou hast not the power to dispel those clouds and those phantoms which thou hast discovered or created, then withdraw this penurious and malignant ray. I'll despise philosophy and renounce its guidance. Let my soul dwell in common sense." Thank you very much. I would welcome your questions. Yes. Yeah. Trying to find who it is.
That beauty is determined by excellence, correct?
So it's an expression of excellence, yeah.
By excellence of the object. So isn't the argument of subjectivity based on the subjective nature of the object and who determines whether or not it's excellent?
It depends on things. Well, that's the question of whether or not things have natures. Do things have a nature?
Wasn't that determined then by the nature of that object?
Well, it can. Yeah, it certainly usually does, but not in nature itself, like what determines the nature of the dog, other than the internal constitution of what it means to be a canine, right? There's an internal order there. And so that's why you have like the Westminster Dog Show, right? What's that all about? What are they judging? Well, there's an excellence there that those people can identify. I can't. I don't get it. I love dogs. I have dogs, but I don't get those dog shows, right? But I recognize that some dog, like, I mean, a dog that is, you know, one-legged, right, with its tail cut off, matted hair, no teeth, is less excellent in some way according to the nature of what a dog should be than a well-fed, well-groomed, four-legged dog.
But doesn't the owner of that dog see that dog?
Oh, no, I love it, certainly. But we would recognize that it's not fully what it could be, right? We'd say that I would love it, and yes, and there is a certain beauty in the love, and that comes, I wouldn't deny that at all. But I think we would recognize that, but it's not entirely meant to be what it should be, according to just the nature of a canine. Yeah, they have this ugly dog in the world contest, yeah. Because they're still loved, right? Dogs are universally loved. Cats, well. We can agree that the excellence of the nature of a cat is questionable. Maybe that's the hole in my whole argument here. I don't know. Yeah, I think you, yeah. Okay. Yes. Right. Yeah, I mean, the question that I would ask them is, why do they prefer the one or the other? Right? Have them, just, if they, I mean, if they're open to, if they say, yeah, I recognize there's something better here, I just don't like it. There's some pop music I do like sometimes better than certain classical music, right? But I would ask that question, well, why? What is it that's shaping you to like that particular kind of music? And part of it has to do with its simplicity. There's not a lot of complex harmonies. There's not a lot of, you know, chord progression, that kind of thing. And to say that it's not bad to love, to find those things attractive, right? But the goal, and this is something that Adler points out, he says, with regard to our personal tastes and teaching of education, right, the best we can do what we want to try to do is to align our preferences with what is actually excellent in the thing, but not to ignore our personal tastes and preferences. Those are there, and I mean, it's perfectly valid. It's true that beauty is, there's a subjective element to beauty. That's perfectly true. But if they're willing and open, then it's just a matter of cultivate. It's going to take time. Like, I would say for the most part, you just don't have the time with your students to cultivate that. It's a lifetime of cultivation. And they're just going to have to choose to understand it more and to, but if they refuse to choose and refuse to pursue it, you can't. There's no way to force them. Yeah. 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 Well, I think it's, yeah. Again, you can't, this kind of goes to this notion, I can't prove to you that a piece of music is beautiful. Right? I mean, we can talk about what makes a piece of music excellent, and I can't prove to you that you ought to enjoy it. Right? I mean, there's no argument I can give you for that. Right? I think this is something that Dr. Turley and I were talking about that he mentioned. I think I got this from him. He's like, I can't prove to you that a piece of cake tastes good. I can invite you to try it, but you've got to taste it. You've got to do the experiment yourself. I can't force you. It's the same with regard to the cultivation of the effect. We can invite. We can expose. But they have to ultimately be open and taste. I can't force that. Yes, sir, in the back in the checkered shirt there. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. 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 Right. 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 No, you know, I think that's true. I remember in college, I did this epiphany came to me as I was thinking about the music I listened to. It hit me, why do I like this? Why do I listen to this music? And I started looking back at the music I listened to, and I noticed that my music preferences changed as my circle of friends changed. And it wasn't until I was sort of on college and on my own that I thought, what music do I actually like? Right? And then the next question that I asked was, well, what's good music? And that started me down a whole, you know, a whole path. But also at the same time, I would say that there's no, that within music, which is using music as an example, there's no best piece of music, right? There's no ultimate beautiful piece of music, I would say. That within music, different genres have different degrees of excellence and different, you know, I mean, so, you know, there's excellent country music, as much as I'll hate to admit that, because I don't have a personal preference for it, right? And there's some excellent pop music, there's not much, right? And there's some excellent rap music, and there's, right? These things are, there is a degree of excellence there, right? And so that's just a matter of being open and appreciating it and not being swayed by, you know, what society tells me I should listen to. But yeah, I mean, I was probably 23, 24 before I had that thought of what music do I even like? Yes, sir.
I'm reminded about what C.S. Lewis said about, you know, becoming like Christ, and how many people, that the closer to Christ we become, the more unique and individual
yes.
we are.
Yes.
And that the tyrants are all monotonously alike.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Because then it's the expression of our own unique nature being made in the image of God, but that is expressed in a unique way through Christ, right? And that's then we have a unique excellence that is played to the highest degree, right, in union with God.
And then also going to your point earlier about the idea of trying to narrow down
right.
beauty to a single principle.
Right. It's the divine essence. Yeah, it is. Ultimate beauty is the divine essence because it's the source of all nature. So it's the most excellent expression of anything. So therefore, the divine is the most beautiful ultimately. Yeah. Oh, is there maybe one more question in the back there, the blue shirt there? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right. Depending on it depends on the nature of the thing. Like, I don't know if a mathematical theorem has texture, right? It just depends upon the nature of the thing. It might, yeah, yeah. Oh, certainly, yeah. But it's not, but again, that, there's not, a, I would say, a single principle that I can apply. It depends upon the object of the thing.
But the multiple attributes working together
Oh yeah, that's that kind of harmony that, yeah. Yeah, there is a kind of, because it does produce a kind of an agreeable quality with us. That's why Plotinus says that, you know, this is one of those lofty things of beauty that sometimes we get lost in. Plotinus says that beauty is the splendor translucence of the one shining through the material phenomenon, right? It's the pattern of the divine expressed in the individual to the mind. And that's what beauty is. And I think that's the expression of beauty. It's of the excellence of the object. And so there is a kind of orderliness to it. But the orderliness will depend upon the nature of the object for what it means for that thing to be orderly. Yes, ma'am, one last thing, and it's 10:50. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, even like a torture rack can be beautiful, even though its purpose is maybe malicious, right? The way it's ordered and the way that it's put together can have there can be a beautiful kind of torture device. It's in the nature of it being put together. But its beauty is not in its function, right? Beauty is not related to function. It's simply related to the order of the thing and the nature of the thing, right? Beauty is not, you know, the beauty of a car is not really related to whether or not the car is functional. That's a different kind of good. That's the goodness of the car, is whether it's functional. But its beauty is simply in its, you know, that you might argue whether or not it can be excellent according to its nature if it doesn't function, but that might be a different argument. So, but yeah, but functionality is not what makes a thing beautiful. Even though that's the progressive, that's the modern, that's the American version of beauty. Beauty is what works. It's functional. All right, well, we're out of time. We'd be happy to talk about this more one-on-one with any of you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Because we have, well, because it itself, because there is something in the object, but my apprehension of it, my experience of it is a subjective experience. The pleasure I experience is subjective to me. I don't have the same pleasure in the same object that you do. The pleasure is subjective. The same is true of truth. There is a dimension of subjectivity to truth in that my mind has to grasp the truth, but nobody else's mind can do that. But even though there is something objective in the nature of truth, right, truth is out there, but the mind is subjective in the grasping of the mind. That's what we call knowledge. So it's both. There's both. Adler says that there's two kinds of beauty. There's enjoyable beauty, that's the subjective pleasure, and the admirable beauty. And the admirable beauty is the expression of the actions of the object. I may be able to admire something, but derive no pleasure from it. I can appreciate and admire a Bach fugue. I don't get it. I want harmonies and I just all these mathematical progressions and I just get bored with them, right? But I admit there's something beautiful there.